Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning into episode 141 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. About 141, this was the year that the Temple of Faustina in Rome was dedicated, at the height of the Roman Empire, to Emperor Antoninus's wife, and dedicated to the emperor as well when he died 20 years later. Conversion to a Christian church preserved quite a bit from destruction, so you can see it today. And if you want to make an anonymous call in the UK, you first dial 141. You never know when that might come in handy. You can email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crowe with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen to us every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on prn.fm, or download the program after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast programs. You can also listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. phone number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. You will be responsible for any long-distance charges. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. If you would like to sponsor this show as an individual or advertiser, please contact me. You can donate via PayPal using the email david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. You can go to infectiousmyth.com/donate.php for more information. We are also at patreon.com/infectiousmyth if you want to make a monthly donation. Even a dollar a month helps a little. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information you are gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of on science, medicine, viruses, democracy, or other social issues, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. I appreciate you listening, commenting, and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. One listener, Matt, wrote on the Infectious Myth Facebook page, and he was talking about the recent episode where we talked about pesticides and GMO. Hi, David. I went over to debate with the pro-GMO engineers on a few of their sites in the last couple of years. I presented the argument that none of their studies, for the most part, go beyond 3 months in rats, and wondered why they did not support longer-term studies. Most of them claimed something to the effect that the longer a study goes on, the greater the chance that the data will be corrupted by confounding factors of some sort. Are you familiar with this argument? Well, it does seem like a strange argument. It could also be that if the rats get sick after a few months, it's actually an effect of the GMOs. If you're going to ascribe everything to confounding factors, then it would be pretty hard to do any research. And if they're saying you can't possibly know that in the long term GMOs will be safe, then maybe they shouldn't be used. He went on to say, most of my experiences with these people were very strange. It seemed that they claimed to be professional scientists, but their demeanor was that of a juvenile. They insisted good studies existed that were over 3 months, but when they posted them, they had a count of rats of less than 10, which again causes all kinds of problems. If you have a population of 10, then a problem that occurs, say, in 1 out of 1,000 people or rats would not be possible to be detected. I appreciate everybody's comments, so keep them coming. Joan Shenton is a former guest 2 or 3 times on this show, where she's discussed her documentary Positive Hell, about a group of people in Spain who've lived years with an HIV-positive diagnosis, mostly without AIDS drugs. And we've also talked about the censorship of that film at least 3 times at 2 film festivals in England, one ironically called the London Independent Film Festival. It wasn't very independent when a couple of AIDS charities phoned up and started complaining about the denialists. And also at a very progressive bookstore in New York City called Blue Stockings. Well, finally, the Index on Censorship, which is a charity that studies censorship, judging obviously by the name, has published a report on the censorship of Positive Hell, which describes quite nicely the events that happened and does describe the rather vague reasons why people thought that the movie was dangerous. I don't know how a movie that actually describes people's life stories could be dangerous. If there's an explanation out there for the reason why these people stayed healthy for years without AIDS drugs that doesn't involve questioning the HIV/AIDS dogma, then surely people should bring that forwards instead of trying to suppress people's life stories. And now, let's get to this week's guest. Brian Friedman is the screenwriter and executive producer of the recently released movie, The King of New Orleans, and a reporter at Nola V, a life and culture online publication devoted to New Orleans. For 12 years, he was a contributing writer and photographer at the Times-Picayune. He's 39 and studied anthropology at Harvard. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Thank you very much, David. I will just make one quick correction. I was not a photographer. But everything else in there was perfect.
Okay. So I called you because we want to talk about Melania Trump's speech at the Republican National Convention. And there were at least a couple of paragraphs that seemed to have been taken from a speech by Michelle Obama. For example, Michelle said, "You work hard for what you want in life. Your word is your bond. Then you do what you say you're going to do. You treat people with dignity and respect." Melania said, "You work hard for what you want in life. Your word is your bond, and you do what you say and keep your promise that you treat people with respect." Michelle said, "The only limit to the height of achievements is the reach of your dreams and your willingness to work for them." And Melania said, "The only limit to your achievements is the strength of your dreams and your willingness to work for them." But this was blamed on a woman that... It was not blamed on Melania, it was blamed on her speechwriter, a woman named
Meredith
McIver. Okay, so what do we know about Meredith McIver?
We know very little. We know she is a longtime employee of the Trump Organization. She's a ghostwriter for several of Trump's books. Her office is supposedly right outside Donald Trump's office in Trump Tower. But the only documented sighting of her was by a reporter named Gabby Wood, who at the time was writing for The Guardian, and this was 10 years ago. And it was a five-second encounter, which Gabby now says she doesn't remember very well at all, or she didn't remember what Meredith looked like. And I guess, you know, we just want something a little more solid and current. But...
Well, I mean, when you say say that she was a writer for Donald Trump, I mean, are you saying that her name was used on on documents? Nobody's actually seen her put pen to paper to actually write something or interviewed her about the writing or anything like that?
Nobody's ever interviewed her as far as we can tell, ever.
But we did get a letter from her, like in July 20th, 2016. It said, "To whom it may concern, my name is Meredith McIver, and I'm an in-house staff writer at the Trump Organization. I'm also a longtime friend and admirer of the Trump family." And then she goes on to say how Melania Trump admired Michelle Obama and read some passages from Mrs. Obama's speech as examples, and then she says, "I wrote them down and later included some of the phrasing in the draft that ultimately became the final speech. I did not check Mrs. Obama's speeches. That was my mistake, and I feel terrible for the chaos I have caused Melania and the Trumps, et cetera, et cetera." Then she resigned.
Yes. Oh, she offered to resign, and then Trump said, "No, people make mistakes," and he refused her resignation.
Right. Mr. Trump told me that people make innocent mistakes and that we learn and grow from these experiences.
Right. So, going back to the speech, first of all, a lot of credit needs to be given to a journalist named Jarek Hill. And he was the person who first recognized that, hey, wait a second, this speech Melania is giving sounds an awful lot like Michelle Obama's speech. And if it weren't for his sharp eyes, no one would have ever figured that out. And he's been one of the few journalists that I've grown to respect through this process. But after the speech and when the plagiarism was announced, the explanations were so ridiculous. At one point, Sean Spicer went on TV with a
Sean
My Little
Spicer
Pony.
Said yes. Something ridiculous? That's a yeah. news flash.
Yeah. good point. But, you know, he actually he went on TV with a My Little Pony toy box and was saying, you know, hey, these words that Melania said are so out, you know, are so in the, you know, you can find them on a My Little Pony toy box. And then, of course, you know, it came out that, okay, yes, there was plagiarism. A day and a half after the speech. So there was a day and a half where, you know, Team Trump must have just been, you know, trying to figure out how to, you know, spin their way out of this one. And ultimately, you know, Meredith MacGyver's letter appeared. And that letter was really one of the first things that seemed strange because, you know, I'm about to be 40, and in my entire life, you know, whenever something, you know, someone shows up on the news having done something, you see a picture of their face. But in this situation, we just see a picture of this letter. And that just seemed a little weird to begin with. And then, you know, the next day, Joy Reid of MSNBC tweeted, you know, honest question, has anyone, you know, is Meredith a real person? And she asked that because of the precedent. And this is something that, you know, I may come back to a lot. There's a precedent of Donald Trump inventing employees. He used to talk to reporters and, you know, in a fake voice, call himself John Miller or John Barron, a spokesman for Trump.org, and would talk about the women that wanted to date Trump. You know, so there is a precedent for similar kinds of fraud here.
Well, so, the letter does say, Mr. Trump told me that people make innocent mistakes and that we learn right. and grow from these experiences. That kind of makes Mr. Trump look good.
It does.
it's almost and the suspicion that maybe he wrote that sentence.
Well, you know, there's just so many odd things about it. But, you know, you've got a situation where there's a precedent. You've got a situation where Trump, who is a constant liar, who's never done anything to, you know, give people reason to give him the benefit of the doubt. But for some reason, the press just seemed to buy this whole explanation and move on. And a lot of us out here, this is not just me. There's other people who have done more work on this than I have. There are thousands of people who are interested in this and are just kind of baffled why the media was just so quick to, you know, buy the explanation and move on.
I thought there were three interesting things about the plagiarism, or three problematical things. I mean, the first is that it's plagiarism, which indicates dishonesty, which obviously
exactly.
you don't want to see.
Yeah.
You don't want to see in a president or their family, the first lady. But also, the second thing is it was plagiarism of a person that the Trump has had a hate on for, well, or at least her husband. For a long time. He wasn't born in America. He doesn't have the right to run for president, et cetera, et cetera. I'm sure there's a long list of bad things Trump said about the Obamas. But here his wife is quoting his enemy.
I guess his belief.
Right. I guess the only thing worse would have been if she plagiarized Hillary Clinton.
Maybe. You're right.
And
keep in mind, Meredith is supposed to be an experienced, you know, writer, and to make this kind of mistake just is a little bit beyond belief as well. But sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah. And I guess the third thing I was going to say is that if you copy somebody else's thoughts, it sort of leaves open the possibility you don't really believe them. You're just saying nice words because they sound good, as opposed to writing them yourself.
Exactly.
But yeah, the letter is a bit strange because it says, over the phone, she read me some passages from Mrs. Obama's speech as examples. Now she's saying, well, okay, that just seems strange that you would do that, as opposed to saying, you know, here are my values that I want conveyed in a speech. Can you make them into kind of nice, coherent thoughts for me as a speechwriter?
Right.
as opposed to, well, here's what Abraham Lincoln said, here's what Michelle Obama said, can you do something with this?
Exactly.
What would you do? So did some of the press try to have an interview with Meredith McIver?
Well, and that's, so I started to reach out to the press, you know, kind of asking why no one had not just interviewed her, but laid eyes on her. And I was kind of astounded by some of the responses I got. I was told by the Associated Press in New York City that they tried to meet her, but it didn't work out. And I said, that's it. And they said, well, why don't you try to find her? And then they hung up on me. Same with the Associated Press in D.C. They could not have been ruder or more condescending. And that's sort of been the general reaction I've gotten from most every reporter. Just a lot of condescension, and we just don't understand why what we're asking for is unreasonable. I mean, sure, if we were asking for something that involved months of digging through files, okay, I get it. But what we're asking for, which is just a face-to-face meeting between a reporter and Meredith, would take a lunch break.
It shouldn't take very long at all. I mean, and you'd think that TV, which is always kind of looking for inside the Beltway kind of people to interview, like something, some new fresh meat, right? They would love to have her, and maybe she could cry on the television, or she could just emphasize how sorry she is or something. It'd be good.
You'd think that Trump would want her to tell that story of how empathetic he was, but she is not talking. She is not, visible.
But let's do a thought experiment for a moment and say that Meredith McIver doesn't exist. Okay,
yes.
So then the question is, who wrote those words? Was it in fact Melania, or was it some other speechwriter who they don't want to fire, and they don't want getting the blame?
Well, that's a good question, David, but I have to say that really my whole focus on this mission is the media. You know, it's more about did Maggie Haberman and Jason Horowitz of the New York Times, you know, the paper of record, write a puff piece about a woman, you know, if we continue this thought experiment, that does not exist. You know, is Meredith McIver the canary in the bad journalism coal mine is really what we're interested in.
Okay, well, you're telling me something I didn't know. So you're saying that the New York Times wrote a piece about Meredith McIver?
Yes, a lot of outlets did at the time, often with the same information that was fed by the Trump Organization, that she's a former ballerina and, you know, some other stuff that I told you earlier. And so Jason Horowitz actually is one of the first reporters I reached out to, and, you know, I kind of emailed him, well, you know, why didn't anyone actually go meet this woman because of, like I said, the precedent of past fakes? And I never heard back. And then I thought I'd be clever, and at the time I was working for the Times Picayune newspaper here in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I'd be clever, and I'd say, hey, Jason, you know, the Times Picayune down here is thinking of running a story about Meredith McIver possibly being, you know, a fake or something else might be weird about her. Never heard back. And that was a lie. The Times Picayune was not. You know, they have no idea what I was doing. and so a couple days later, I get a call from my boss, and I've been fired by the Times Picayune because apparently, instead of responding to me directly, Jason had been forwarding my emails to his boss, and his boss called my boss, and I was fired on the spot. And it's okay. It's actually okay because at the time I was only doing some home and garden stuff for them, which is really not my specialty at all. But it stung a little bit in the way I was not, you know, backed up at all. And I enjoyed my time at the Times Picayune writing about Katrina recovery and things like that.
Right.
So it stung a little bit like that. But ultimately, I think anyone that was interested in home and garden stuff better off with me not doing that anymore.
Right. I mean, I guess it's true that you say that the Times Picayune was not thinking about this writing this article, but it seems strangely It seems strange that he wouldn't just call your bluff or something, but it actually went up a level
just
across.
Just respond to me. That would have probably saved a lot of, you know, problems. I just kind of feel like that was a poor way for him to handle it. But that, again, like, this is a long time ago. I mean, obviously the search for Meredith is more important than that, you know, and it continues.
Yeah, I mean, I see what you're saying is that, you know, if it turned out that, say, Donald Trump had written this letter and Meredith MacIver never existed, he'd get some criticism, but, you know, Trump's history has been he doesn't care.
Well, that's true. You know, continuing the thaw experiment, you know, if she never existed, then, you know, he blames her for some errors in the book while he was under oath in an 07 deposition. So if she is fake, then Trump committed perjury in that deposition. But we're not just operating under, you know, the theory she never existed. There's a lot of evidence that there is a Meredith MacIver out there. You know, we want to know, is she just, you know, sort of this person that he uses as a scapegoat somehow? Is she someone that may have, you know, had a stroke 5 years ago and Trump conveniently uses her as someone he can blame? You know, we just want to, you know if she's a healthy human being walking around in 2017. And we also think she could just be a very private person. And if a reporter finds out that she's just a very private person, I will thank that reporter.
Right.
I won't apologize for any of this because I think it's been a completely reasonable search, and I'll go about my next project.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is reasonable for a number of reasons. I mean, the fact that Trump has in the past invented people means that it's reasonable to ask for the authenticity.
That's what it's all
of this
about.
Person. And
yeah.
It could be that Meredith MacIver is just a scapegoat, and
yes,
like I postulated, maybe there's another speech writer that he wanted to protect from the fallout from this. I mean,
some people think Jason Miller might be that guy, but I mean, honestly, we just don't know.
Yes,
you know.
But your bigger point is about the media, and now if the media had done some. Okay, so the media is always talking about fact-checking. They're always talking about don't believe the fake news. We're the New York Times. We're the Washington Post.
Yep.
We don't do fake news. But if you write a piece about a woman and don't verify that she actually really exists, you never talk to her, that doesn't sound right. That sounds like you could be writing fake news.
That's our whole point. That's our entire point. We just want to know. We just want to gauge where the press is. You know, a lot of people, including myself, feel like the press failed us in this election by not being aggressive enough, calling Trump on his many lies, while at the same time elevating, you know, Hillary's emails to this to the same degree as, you know, Trump's many, you know, outrages.
Uh-huh.
And they refuse to acknowledge that, which is also kind of frustrating. And in that way, they're kind of like Trump. They refuse to recognize their own flaws, and that's been frustrating as well.
Yeah, I mean, my feeling is that if they got to the bottom of both candidates, neither of them would have run.
Well, and look, I mean, Hillary was a flawed candidate, but was she eminently qualified? Yes. She, you know, a decent human being, yes, and I would vote for her a million times, you know, again over someone like Trump. But again, you know, really, this whole thing is about the press. It's about gauging their competence. That's all it's about right now.
Right, right. I understand that. That is. I think the deeper. I mean, that's what I was going to ask you. Is like, why is this important? But you're saying, if the press just kind of fell for a ruse. And then it's trying
what
to cover
else are
up
they
the
falling
fact.
For?
Yeah,
yeah.
They're trying to cover up the fact that they wrote a story about a fake person, or maybe Meredith MacIver exists, but the information about her is fake. So it's essentially a fake person. We don't know. Was she really a ballerina?
Yeah.
How could you? I mean, I don't understand how they could do this without ever talking to the person involved. I mean,
hence the whole second line parade down Fifth Avenue. I mean,
let's talk about that, because that's a very unique and New Orleans way to deal with this situation. So you had a parade in New York. because of Meredith MacIver. So explain that.
Yes, we had a second line parade from Trump Tower down to starting at the New York Times and down about eight blocks to Trump Tower, but eight New York City blocks. It was a little bit of a hike, and we had the Jambalaya Brass Band and a great group of dancers, and I'm mad that I'm forgetting their names right now, but we thought that having something like that would raise attention to what we were, trying to say, and I gotta say, New York City, it's tough to get noticed because, that parade was months ago, and we're still looking for Meredith, so... in some ways, it may not have been a success, but it was definitely an interesting experience.
How did you persuade so many people to get involved with the parade? I saw some video of it, and it's quite a lot of fun.
It was funny, because I really thought it would be difficult to get people to join this mission, I guess I keep calling it. But, the first band I called, the Jambalaya Brass Band, immediately they were like, oh yeah, let's do this. They were into it. Same with the dancers.
And were they all in New York City, or did everybody travel?
Yes. No, these are New Yorkers.
Okay.
New Yorkers. It was a lot of fun. It started off a little rough at the New York Times building. They weren't happy about us massing there. But eventually, once we got going, it was a lot of fun, and you're right. We thought it was a great New Orleans way to raise attention, kind of irreverent. Like we say in the clip, if she is real, she needs to get out more, and we're bringing a party to her. And that's what we do. And
who doesn't like New Orleans music?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. It is the city of music for sure. I remember, what was it? There was a James Bond movie where didn't they kill somebody during a funeral parade in New Orleans or something? I forget.
That's a good question. As someone in the film business here, I can tell you most films set in New Orleans are terrible, and people tend not to remember too much. So that scene is not ringing a bell. But you very well could be correct.
Yeah, I think they put like the coffin down on the ground and put the body inside the coffin and off they went again or something like that. I don't know. I have this sort of vague memory of that. And so the New York Times is still not talking to you after.
Oh, no. Actually, it's funny. The head of the New York Times, Dean Bakke, is a New Orleans guy, and he is the one who I got the most response from, and I got a one-word response from him, just interesting. And that was it, but that's the most response I've ever gotten from the New York Times. And I heard from the Washington Post, Pulitzer Prize winner David Fahrenthold, who, to his credit, was also one of the more receptive people to listening to my story. He actually called me back. Actually, I found out we were college classmates. I had no idea, but he told me, and I guess he might be mad for me saying this, but he told me that the research department at the Washington Post, quote, just assumed she's real, and that was it. And that seemed kind of strange. I mean, to me, isn't the exact opposite of research assuming something?
Right.
I mean.
Yeah.
So and that's all I heard from them, and that was it. I never heard back from them. So.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you don't need to research whether Donald Trump exists or something. You don't need to go to absurd levels to fact check everything. But for a person who nobody appears to ever seen except maybe this one person for a few seconds, whose name appears very occasionally.
And only to be blamed, usually.
Right.
Something.
Like, you would think that she would have appeared at some parties with the Trumps or something like that. There would be a photo, some society page photo or something like that.
Exactly. And there are those for Trump's other, former assistants, but not for this woman. And, in fact, a lot of the photos that are out there online are Photoshop. There's just a lot of strange stuff. I mean, fake Twitter accounts and Facebook accounts that appeared for after the speech. Reports that Jason Miller tried to hire someone to create these fake accounts after the convention, because questions would be asked. Now, I can't confirm that at all. That's just, something I heard. Just a lot of reasons to look into it. One of those fake Twitter accounts that I communicated with all of a sudden started speaking in Russian, which was strange. So I guess there's just, a lot of strange stuff, and it's worth someone taking a lunch break to go, just shake hands with this lady, lay eyes on her, see if she's okay.
Yeah, well, Trump Tower's in New York City, right? So
that's
the New York
right.
Times, this would be pretty easy on the way to lunch.
Eight blocks. I led a second line on the exact route. It would not take them that long.
And supposedly she has an office right outside Donald Trump's or something, you said?
Close enough so that he just couldn't yell Meredith, and she supposedly can come right in. According to him, she's heard everything. So just in that regard, she'd be someone that would be interesting to talk to.
Yeah, I want to talk to her. My next interview.
Yes.
Right.
Well, join the search. Join the search, David.
Okay. Well, if I scoop you, I'll tell you afterwards.
as long as we get to the truth, I'll be happy, David.
Okay. Well, another strange thing I heard today, which sort of matches the plagiarizing of Michelle Obama's words, was that Jared Kushner, that's Trump's son-in-law, right?
Yes.
Didn't disclose his business ties to George Soros. And it's like all my right-wing friends, every time there's a parade that's anti-Donald Trump or something like that, it's like, oh, they're just a bunch of people funded by Soros. I'm still waiting for my check.
Yeah, apparently Soros is funding it all.
But now it turns out he's funding Jared Kushner.
Well, I mean, there's a lot that Jared has not disclosed, which is a whole nother story. It's also, it's weird. No one's ever really heard Jared speak. For a guy who's supposed to be in charge of Middle East peace, revamping how government works, all this stuff. He's not a talkative. He's not a talker. You don't really hear from him very much.
Yeah, you would think that you would want to get out there and express the viewpoints of all the positive changes you're going to make.
Yeah. I'm not making any bizarre conspiracy suggestions here. I'm just saying he seems like a very quiet person.
Yeah, to me, the business ties with George Soros, I'm not so concerned about whether they're valid or corrupt or whatever, because I think there's some shady business dealings that have happened around Donald Trump. This may be quite legitimate, but just the fact that he would associate with somebody who's just so toxic to conservatives in America seemed ironic. To me, just like if Melania was going to plagiarize, like there's a lot of right-wing women, Republican women that she could have plagiarized from.
Yeah.
You think?
But Michelle Obama, I mean, honestly, so much of this campaign and election, it's like you could not write this. If you wrote this in a screenplay, they would just say ridiculous. Forget it. This is ridiculous.
Okay. Is there anything else we need to talk about Meredith McIver? Because I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your movie, The King of New Orleans.
Okay. I think the only thing I'm gonna say about Meredith is, we're still pushing and want to help us out. I'm not sure how, but just speak out if you think the press should make a little bit more of an effort, and that's where I'll leave it.
Yeah, and I guess if anybody's been to Donald Trump's office and saw Meredith McIver, that would be really useful information. Yeah,
the only people that have said they have are Piers Morgan and Jeffrey Lord. So in other words, no one with any credibility.
Okay, you're not a Piers Morgan fan.
Not in the least.
I did love his interview with Alex Jones over gun control.
I did not see that, but Jones.
That is a classic.
I'll check it out. Alex Jones is actually apparently one of Trump's favorite reporters. He said so himself. So
yeah, well,
that shows you.
Piers Morgan is pro-gun control, right? And so he wanted to interview Alex Jones about guns, and Alex Jones lost it. It was interesting to me because if you watch the video, depending on what side you're on, you either see this bombastic Alex Jones just yelling at Piers Morgan and making a fool of himself, or if you're on Alex Jones' side, it's like he sure showed Piers Morgan who's boss. So, and that's kind of the divide in America at this time, which I think is kind of sad that there's seems to be less and less people in the middle saying, can you both sides grow up?
You're absolutely right. It's you know, honestly, it feels, you know, with Trump's recent comments about the Civil War, which were hilarious in their ignorance, but you know, it feels like there's kind of a civil war in this country, a nonviolent one, thankfully. But just the divide, like you said, is so intense right now. It's amazing.
Right, but I'm also like a lot of people think, you know, Hillary should have won. She got more votes. She's had more government experience, etc. But on the other hand, I mean, the choice was between the right-wing party of war or the left-wing party of war, the people who hate the minimum wage and the people who say, well, maybe one day in the distant future we'll have an increase in the minimum wage, but you know we'll probably never give you one.
Right.
The people who want to be tough on crime and the people on the left who are tough on crime, even though they say they're not. So it's like America doesn't really have a choice of, what about single-payer healthcare? Where's the party of single-payer healthcare?
Right. And everything you said, David, is correct. I would add, though, that I think there's a lot of people like myself for whom this went beyond Republican and Democrat. This went to just the person, you know, and a lot of people just find Donald Trump unacceptable and morally repugnant, just unsuited for this office in a million different ways. That you know, for me, I, you know, it's when he started the whole birther movement. Mm-hmm. You know, that's immediately when I'm like, well, this is someone I wouldn't invite into my home, much less vote for president. You know, this is someone who, you know, has everything I was taught growing up, he seems to go against, and yet he was voted president. It's a little bit disconcerting.
Right. I mean, I think there are some parallels between Bill Clinton and Donald Trump in terms of their attitude towards women. But Bill Clinton was almost impeached over that.
Yes,
and with Donald Trump, it's just like, well, it's locker room talk, right?
Exactly.
Can you imagine if a tape surfaced of say, Barack Obama saying, you know, making pussy grabbing comments? Can you imagine what would have happened if that had come out?
You know, there's so many things that if, you know, anyone else had done them, it would have been the end. But I don't understand why Trump is given sort of this free path to do and say these things. Maybe it's just because he was a big celebrity beforehand. I don't know. But it's shocking, you know. If you know, reading something the other day, if you put Hillary Clinton's name into, you know, instead of Trump, some of the things that he's done, you'd be like, well, that's ridiculous. She would never have lasted even 100 days in office, you know. There's a strange, something strange going on with that.
Yes. Okay, so tell me about your new movie, The King of New Orleans. What is it
about? The King
of
New Orleans is kind of a cross between Good Will Hunting and Taxi Cab Confessions. The main character is a New Orleans cabbie who meets a kid who just got kicked out of Harvard, and he kind of helps the kid out, and later on the kid kind of helps the cabbie out, and it's a totally authentic New Orleans movie. You know, like I was saying earlier, most movies set in New Orleans are not good, and it's because they try to overdo the New Orleans angle, which is a mistake because you don't have to. New Orleans is going to be pretty interesting on its own. You should just let it be itself, and that's what we do. And you know, it's a small indie, but we won some, you know, did well at some film fests, and we're just hoping the movie gets some more eyeballs.
Okay, well, I'll definitely put a link in the show notes to some of your stuff.
Amazon, iTunes, and Google Play, and Comcast On Demand, and maybe Netflix in the summer.
How has New Orleans changed since Hurricane Katrina? I remember a lot of talk.
Drastically.
Yeah, it's whitened.
I would say so. It's gotten more expensive. There's definitely some of that going on, and that's not good. There's still neighborhoods that have some issues from Katrina, but there's also been a lot of significant change for the better. I mean, the schools now aren't perfect by any stretch, but it's better than what was there beforehand, which was failing, everybody. And, there is an influx of sort of new energy and youth and entrepreneurship. But, like we said earlier, it's balancing that with not, losing the flavor and the character and the culture of the city.
Yeah, well, it is very unique, but it goes a long way beyond the French Quarter, right? Like it's a lot of complexity, and it's in danger. It could be seen as just a theme park, right?
That's a fear. I'm not worried about that happening, tomorrow. But it's always something. We definitely don't want that to happen here. That's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think of Venice in Italy, where it's become so expensive that nobody who works there can afford to live there unless you have a family house. So it just becomes this increasingly artificial place where most people who stay overnight in Venice are tourists in hotels.
Yeah.
Because it's far more profitable to turn a house into a hotel than to have people living there.
I think there are certain things about New Orleans, though, that I think will always help. It's geographically, it's more compact than a lot of cities, and, we didn't have as many people fleeing to the suburbs. People still have to live together and get along, and I don't think that will ever change. We've got a big argument going on about tearing down Confederate monuments. Even though a lot of the people that are protesting have come in from, Mississippi or Arkansas, it's still, kind of odd that there are people so tight to that they are, are out and, protesting. But that's their right. That's their right in this country.
Yes. Well, in the city that I live in Canada, we had a bridge, the Langevin Bridge, which, just seemed like a historical name. I knew nothing about this person, but apparently this person was one of the architects of the residential school system, which was intended to destroy the native culture in Canada, and did a really good job of its intended aim. So there was a big debate about changing the name of the bridge to not honor a person who did some pretty horrible things to natives. And I guess this is the Confederate monuments and other memories of the Confederate era is going to be a debate for a long time, because there is a legitimate need to remember history, right? As Donald Trump explained. Yeah.
that's my feeling exactly. Like I would worry if we can't forget is what I'm trying to say. Mm-hmm. We just cannot forget these things, or else we could repeat them. But at the same time, it doesn't feel right to honor what these people stood for either. And so it's an interesting discussion.
Yeah, because a statue in a park of a general on a horse is honoring that person. It's hard to just see it as history. So there has to be other ways, because you certainly don't want people to forget about history of an incredibly divisive war, which still has echoes today in slavery. The prison system and the over-incarceration of black people and things like that.
Well, Louisiana is the number one incarcerating state and the number one incarcerating nation. So we definitely have that, almost full to prison pipeline, unfortunately.
And it's actually slavery does legally exist in America, there's an exception for prisons. So is it the 13th Amendment or something that basically says there's no slavery except for somebody who's incarcerated? So
this is another indictment of our education system that as a Canadian no more.
I know a lot of useless, disconnected facts. But now I know a lot about Meredith MacIver,
which may
prove to be completely useless if she doesn't exist.
If she doesn't exist, I think it's useful, because now we know that the best of the best aren't doing a very good job, I guess.
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot of hypocrisy amongst the mainstream media when they legitimately criticize the fake news media, but they're not without their defects.
Absolutely.
Yes, and I think this illustrates that they would just be willing to throw fact-checking out the window and...
And also just not doing, old-fashioned legwork, literal legwork, like walking down there and finding her. I just was strange, that the proof that these people would give for her existence would be linking to another story written by someone who did not go see Meredith. And they would link to another story in which the reporter never, just a kind of a circular firing squad of, like, laziness and incompetence. And, what happened to just, like I said, taking a walk down and just making sure with your own eyes?
Well, yes. I mean, the first person who gets a TV interview with Meredith MacIver has a huge scoop.
Yes, they do, and I will shake that person's hand.
Yes,
I will throw them a second line parade. Let's just say that.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Well, we'll look forward to another parade in New York City sometime. Another good New Orleans.
Let's hope so. And you're invited, David.
Thank you. I love New Orleans music. I've been to New Orleans a few times, and the music
is
great.
Come see us anytime.
Okay, I hope to get down there another time, sometime soon. Well, thank you for joining me today. I really appreciate you spending time with me, Brian.
David, thanks for your interest and continued success.
Yes, and after this show airs next Tuesday, I will send you a link to the podcast page.
Sounds good, and I will add one thing. The dance troupe in the clip, the Urban Glam Dance Company, and they're fantastic.
Right, and they both live and work in in New York City. So if anybody's interested in New Orleans music or dance, they know where to turn.
Exactly. Thanks, David.
Okay, thanks, Brian. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
I admit that I did this interview without my normal time to think things through. I phoned up Brian Friedman, and shortly after I was doing the interview, but I felt it left a few loose ends. He was kind enough to continue the dialogue through email afterwards. First, I went to Snopes. Now, I understand Snopes does often have a liberal bias, at least on topics that have a sort of political side to them. So they're to the right of a lot of people who follow Sanders or Nader, but to the left of Republicans. They're more friendly to Hillary than Trump, for example. But I was shocked to see them list all the reasons why Meredith MacIver might not exist, and then conclude at the end of the article that she definitely did exist. On what basis? Two things. A 2007 Guardian article by Gabby Wood, in which Trump is reported to have yelled, "Meredith," and his ghostwriter Meredith MacIver, as named in the Guardian article, walks in with, quote, a few sheets of paper on which a company bio is printed in bold and written in similar fashion. And there is a current voter registration of someone with her name in New York, neither of which seem too compelling, especially since the voter registration, for obvious reasons, has the address of the Meredith MacIver omitted, so you can't go to her door and verify this. But Snopes didn't say, probably this is a false rumor. They just said false, with absolute certainty. But that's not all that's out there. Meredith MacIver showed up in an article after the plagiarism scandal erupted by David Fahrenthold and Robert O'Hara in the Washington Post. In it, they describe what happened when Trump sued a reporter and ended up being deposed. He was questioned about a 2004 book, How to Get Rich, in which was written that he was 9.2 $2 billion in debt in the early 1990s. This wasn't true, and it exaggerated his comeback. When confronted with this falsehood, Trump blamed, you guessed it, Meredith MacIver. Another book, 3 years later, also gave the same incorrect figure, and I don't need to tell you who Trump blamed that error on. His excuse was that he read the book so quickly he didn't notice the error, except that he was supposed to be the author. But when you're a billionaire, I guess you hire people to do the writing of your own books. And if you hire good people, you don't even have to read them to check to see if there's any errors. The New York Times article from just after the same, similar, just before the Washington Post article, the New York Times article is interesting because although they didn't talk to MacIver, they did talk to a former boyfriend from the 1990s, Stephen Palitz, and a sister who both seem to exist. I tried to friend Palitz, who is a lawyer and classical guitarist, on Facebook, but I didn't get a response. Friedman had had better luck before me. He said, I actually spoke to him on the phone a few months ago. He is one of the precious few people who've gone on record as having spent any time with her, and the conversation left me with far more questions than answers. When I told him we were coming to New York to make a little documentary about the possibility that Meredith MacIver isn't real, his first response to me was not, that's nuts, you're claiming my ex-girlfriend isn't real. No, his first reaction was, okay, who's backing your film? He wanted no part of meeting me or having Meredith meet me or anyone, and he ended up faking a problem with his phone and hung up. Friedman had already got to his sister as well. He told me, Meredith's sister Karen has a publicly listed phone number. I called her a few months ago. To my surprise, she picked up. I explained that I was a reporter who was trying to do a story on her sister Meredith and was hoping to get some contact information, and Karen said, Meredith works for the Trump Organization, so you have to go through them. And then I asked, is she okay? And her response was, yeah, everything's cool. Then she said she had to go and hung up. The New York Times article, which references the supposed former boyfriend Stephen Palitz and the sister Karen, contains two photos that are labeled as being of Meredith MacIver. One is of a slim redhead with green eyes from 1986, and a more contemporary photo provided by Palitz is of a woman with dyed red hair who could possibly be the same woman as the 1986 photo. Larger versions of the recent photo exists on two other websites, including a coffee-focused website magazine called Sprudge, which actually has an article from July of 2016, which is supposedly written by MacIver. But the photo in that article is clearly photoshopped because it contains two large Sprudge coffee mascots pasted on top of the New York Times article photo. Given the clumsy Photoshop job on the photo and the tone of the article, I think it must just be satire. Why would MacIver use the same photo that Palitz gave to the New York Times if she was real? Is this even important? Well, it's interesting and stimulating, and we all need that. But I think it talks about the difficulty of determining the truth in some situations. And the techniques that Friedman used, apart from being amusing in some at some parts, could be used in other cases. It was good detective work. He didn't really leave any loose ends. But in some cases, as in this, the truth seems to be elusive. I'm certainly not ready to pull a Snopes and put a definite true or false on this one. But it also says a lot about the mainstream media, and Brian Friedman was critical of their role in this, because they seem to be satisfied to go along with the sketchy evidence for MacIver, even though it would clearly be possible to push for a definite identity. For example, if Snopes has the voter registration card, the media could definitely get it. Snopes blurred out the address, but with it, the media could certainly go to her residence and at least verify that a woman looking like the woman in Palitz's photo existed, even if they didn't really get to talk to her. Possibly MacIver exists, but is truly a very private person. Maybe she partially exists. By this, I mean, maybe she exists, but isn't the ghostwriter, just someone who has agreed to allow her name to be used and abused for Trump's benefit. Or maybe she totally doesn't exist. I don't know, but I'll certainly let you know if the situation resolved one way or other. And all the links you need to do your own investigations will be in the show notes. Thank you for listening to episode 141 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com, like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. You can commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.